Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling something super relatable, relationships. Mm-hmm. But we're not just scratching the surface here. You sent in a really like thought-provoking bunch of articles and online discussions.
Yeah, that's way next.
They really get into the nitty-gritty of power dynamics, you know, in our closest connections, and also explore the fascinating world of different relationship styles. Stuff beyond the usual monogamy script.
Exactly.
So our mission today is basically to unpack all of this, look for the common threads, and hopefully give everyone some real insights into how we connect.
Yeah, definitely. We've got sources covering everything from, you know, those everyday power plays that happen to things like polyamory, swinging, even dominance and submission.
Wow, quite the range.
It is, but at its heart, it's all about how we navigate intimacy, right?
Yeah.
And the roles we kind of find ourselves playing within those connections.
Okay, let's get into it then. Let's start with something I think we all navigate, maybe without even realizing it sometimes, power dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
That Psych Central article, it really opened my eyes. It's not just about who's in charge, is it?
No, not at all. It's much more about the roles we fall into, especially when things get a bit tricky.
Oh, right.
And what's so interesting is how these roles and, you know, any imbalances that come up, they can show up in really common ways.
Like what?
Well, the article points out that when things feel off kilter, it can lead to that kind of simmering resentment.
Oh, yeah.
Those arguments that just seem to go in circles.
Yeah.
And eventually, like, a real emotional distance.
Mm-hmm.
And the key thing that comes through, really, is that feeling seen and heard.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to be the ticket to getting things back on track.
That sense of validation, empathy.
Exactly. That's the game changer.
Totally. And these imbalances, they can crop up all over the place, can't they? Like money.
Definitely money.
Who initiates sex? Who makes the big life decisions?
Mm-hmm.
Even just who does the chores?
Absolutely. All those areas. And the article breaks down three really common power dynamics.
Mm.
I bet these will ring a bell for a lot of folks. First one is the demand withdrawal dynamic.
Ah, the classic.
It is, isn't it? So you've got one partner, the demander, who feels like their needs just aren't being met.
Right. They keep pushing.
They keep pushing, trying to get their partner to engage with whatever the issue is. Maybe it's needing more support, more affection, better communication, whatever.
Okay.
And then you have the withdrawer who, well, tends to avoid those requests.
Just shuts down.
Sometimes, yeah. Or maybe they're trying to set a boundary, but they're not doing it very clearly. Or perhaps they just feel criticized and shutting down is like their way of coping.
Right. And then what happens? The demander feels totally ignored, frustrated.
Which makes them push even harder.
Exactly. The requests become demands. Maybe fights break out. It's this awful negative cycle.
And the withdrawer. They probably feel constantly under pressure, maybe even controlled.
Which just makes them want to pull back even more.
Precisely. And the article makes a really crucial point. This dynamic just eats away at the trust in the relationship.
Yeah, you can see. So how do you fix it? How do you break that cycle?
Well, the article stresses keeping agreements.
Yeah.
And communicating with respect. Seems simple, but it's hard in practice.
Mm-hmm.
It's about both people really trying to tune in to what the other actually needs. They even suggest some phrases.
Oh, what?
For the demander. Something like, okay, I feel like I need more support with X. What do you think you can realistically take on?
That sounds less attacking.
Right. And for the withdrawer, maybe, look, I feel like I'm letting you down.
Yeah.
Can we get really clear about what we both expect here?
So it's about clarity and mutual expectation.
Yeah. And actively listening, consciously, trying not to just react in those hurtful, knee-jerk ways.
Okay, that makes sense. What's the second dynamic?
The second one is the distancer-pursuer.
Mm-hmm.
This one probably feels familiar, too.
Mm-hmm.
It's where one partner seems, you know, more invested, maybe initiate contact more, plan things more, that kind of energy.
The keen one, maybe.
Kind of, yeah. While the other partner tends to keep a bit more emotional distance.
Okay.
And what's fascinating here is how often this links back to our earliest experiences, like our attachment styles from childhood.
Ah, right. Secure, anxious, avoidant, that stuff.
Exactly. If your caregivers were generally responsive, you tend to feel more secure. But if they were often, say, dismissive or unavailable emotionally.
You learn to keep your distance. Protect yourself.
Understandably, yeah. You might develop a pattern of keeping a bit of space in adult relationships. So one partner might become what they call a maximizer, putting loads of energy into closing that perceived gap.
The pursuer.
Right. While the other becomes a minimizer, pulling away even more, the distancer.
And it's not just about childhood stuff, is it? The article mentioned love languages, too.
Oh, definitely. That plays a huge role. You might be showing love through, I don't know, acts of service, doing things.
Fixing the leaky tap.
Yeah. But if your partner primarily feels love through, say, physical touch or words of affirmation,
they might not even register your effort as love.
Exactly. They might still feel a lack of connection, which makes them pursue more. And you, the fixer, feel like your efforts aren't appreciated, so you pull away.
So the pursuer feels rejected, the distancer feels smothered. Whew, tough spot.
It really is. And shifting this dynamic means both partners kind of have to step outside their comfort zones a bit.
How so?
Well, the distancer could maybe try initiating intimacy sometimes or planning something special, even if it feels a bit unnatural at first.
Take the lead for a change.
Yeah. And the pursuer could try maybe consciously giving their partner a little more breathing room, trusting the connection is still there.
Okay.
The article suggests really focusing on how your partner wants to be loved.
Yeah.
You know, not just how you prefer to show love.
Yeah.
That shift can be really powerful.
That's a great point. Okay. And the third dynamic, fear, shame. This sounds heavier.
It is. Yeah. It often connects to really personal insecurities, emotional pain, maybe for one or both partners.
How does that play out?
Well, it often emerges when one person's underlying fears or anxieties trigger feelings of shame or maybe avoidance in the other partner.
Okay.
And that reaction can then escalate things, maybe more withdrawal, maybe even defensive stuff like aggression. The article points out these patterns are often really deeply rooted, sometimes in past trauma.
Wow. Okay, so that makes them particularly hard to navigate just between the two of you.
For sure. So how do you even start to address something like that?
Yeah.
The article really emphasizes trust and vulnerability.
Yeah.
Creating a truly safe space where you can both process those tough emotions without judgment.
That sounds essential, but maybe difficult to achieve.
It can be.
Yeah.
It's about being brave enough to actually name your vulnerabilities. Like, think of an example. Someone admitting they feel really insecure about their body image.
Okay.
And the key is the partner responding with loving reassurance, validation, not jumping in with unhelpful advice like, well, just go to the gym then.
Right. Not trying to fix it, but just validating the feeling.
Exactly. That kind of response is so crucial. And, you know, the article wisely points out sometimes these patterns are so deep.
You need outside help.
Yeah. Getting professional guidance, maybe from a therapist who gets trauma, can be a really vital step towards healing, both individually and for the relationship.
That makes a lot of sense. It's clear that navigating all these dynamics isn't like a one-time fix. It's ongoing work.
Definitely a process.
But the Psych Central article does give some really practical building blocks for trying to create more balance, doesn't it?
It does. Things like, you know, openness and honesty sounds basic, but crucial for trust.
Mm-hmm. Compromise, too. Actually hearing different points of view.
Right. And respecting boundaries. Listening to needs and preferences and supporting each other's individual interests, that personal growth stuff.
Yeah, not losing yourself in the relationship.
Exactly. And learning to argue fairly seems huge.
Oh, God, yes. Focusing on the issue, not just blaming or dredging up the past.
And building trust. Yeah. Like consciously giving your partner the benefit of the doubt sometimes. Assuming positive intent.
That takes effort.
It does. And they also suggest hitting pause during really heated arguments. Just taking a break to cool down before you say something damaging.
Good advice. Simple, but effective, probably.
And finally, they touch on knowing when it might be time to get some professional support.
When things are really stuck.
Yeah. Like if you're caught in those endless arguments, feeling really angry or distant all the time, if the sex life is tanked, or you're dealing with infidelity.
Or just carrying a lot of personal pain that's spilling over.
Exactly. In those cases, reaching out to a couple's therapist can be an incredibly positive, proactive move.
Having that neutral third party.
Yeah. Someone who can help you both see the patterns and guide you towards healthier ways of communicating. It can be a total game changer.
Okay. So that's a really helpful look at the power plays within relationships generally. Now, let's shift gears a bit. Let's dive into something really fascinating. Alternative relationship styles. You shared that article by Sharon Marie Scott. It really challenges the whole idea that monogamy is the only way, doesn't it?
It really does. What stood out to me is how it frames monogamy as this kind of default setting, you know?
Yeah.
The one that's culturally celebrated, presented as the recipe for living happily ever after, basically from birth.
Right. We just absorb it.
We do. And the author, speaking from their own experience with non-traditional relationships, points out that lots of people only even realize other options exist when they start actively questioning those defaults.
It's like we get this one-size-fits-all template, and if it doesn't quite fit, we might think there's something wrong with us.
Instead of thinking maybe the template isn't the only one.
Exactly. And the article emphasizes we're living in a time of pretty big social change. We're seeing more diversity in how families and relationships look.
Yeah, they shared some interesting stats, too. Like, around 20% of Americans in a 2016 study reported being in some form of consensual non-monogamy.
20%? That's significant.
And a 2023 poll found that about a third of Americans said their ideal relationship was something other than complete monogamy.
Wow. So the desire is definitely there for a lot of people.
It really suggests those traditional rigid structures are evolving, and more people are looking for the freedom to, like, write their own love stories, move beyond some of the limitations that strict monogamy can sometimes impose.
But the author isn't bashing monogamy, right?
No, not at all. They're clear about that. Conscious monogamy is totally valid. It's more about highlighting that there's this wide, valid spectrum of ways to be in relationship.
And that spectrum is pretty diverse. The article mentioned a few styles. Let's start with swinging. How did it describe that?
It described it as primarily involving couples, often heterosexual couples, engaging in casual sexual interactions with others, but crucially, usually without deep emotional involvement.
So the emotional connection stays primarily with the main partner.
That seems to be the general understanding, yeah.
Yeah.
The focus is more on the physical side, the recreational aspect. The article also brings up a couple of interesting points.
Right.
It's like a potentially problematic assumption of female bisexuality that can sometimes exist in those circles.
Okay.
And the observation that women often seem to act as gatekeepers in initiating things.
Interesting. Another power dynamic right there.
Definitely. And the author notes the generally sex-positive vibe in the swinging community. They often call it play.
Creates a sense of fun, adventure maybe.
Yeah. But, and this is important, they also raise a big flag about consent, mentioning that some older members, maybe from different generations, might still hold on to outdated, potentially harmful assumptions. Like a woman just being there means she's available.
Oof. That's not okay anywhere.
Absolutely not.
Oh.
It just hammers home how vital, clear, direct communication and respecting boundaries are. Consent has to be paramount, always, whatever the relationship style.
Absolutely. Okay, another style mentioned was relationship anarchy. That sounds pretty radical.
It really is. It basically throws out the traditional relationship rulebook entirely.
How?
The core idea is that all relationships, romantic, sexual, platonic, family, friends, are considered equally valuable.
Oh, no hierarchy.
Exactly. Yep. No hierarchy putting romantic sexual partnerships automatically at the top. The structure, the rules, the parameters, they're determined only by the people involved, not by society's expectations.
So you define each relationship on its own terms.
Precisely. Through mutual agreement, open communication, they reject those external standards.
That sounds incredibly freeing, and also like it would require a ton of self-awareness and communication skill.
Definitely. The article mentions they often reject labels, too, preferring fluidity based on consent, transparency, and interdependence. There's no assumed relationship escalator.
Escalator.
You know, the idea that relationships naturally progress towards marriage, kids, shared house, that romantic sexual relationships are the ultimate goal or more significant than, say, a really deep friendship.
Right. Okay. Relationship anarchy rejects that progression.
Yeah. The aim seems to be about, like, decolonizing relationships, ensuring no one has inherent power over another person just because of the type of relationship.
Wow. That's a really different way of thinking about connection.
It is. Very thought-provoking.
Now, the author made a really important point about all these alternative styles.
Yeah.
It's not just fun and games, is it?
No, definitely not presented that way. They often demand a lot of self-reflection, inner strength, personal growth.
Right.
In fact, exploring these styles can sometimes shine a spotlight on vulnerabilities you didn't even know you had, things that might stay hidden in a more conventional setup.
That makes sense. Pushes you to confront things.
Exactly. And again, they circle back to say conscious monogamy is absolutely a valid, fulfilling choice too. The ultimate key, it seems, is finding what genuinely brings you fulfillment and authenticity. That includes your relationship with yourself.
That's such a crucial takeaway, isn't it? It's not about judging styles, but about self-discovery. Finding what truly aligns with your values, your desires, your needs, and then building connections with honesty, whatever form they take.
Beautifully put.
Yeah.
Okay, this leads us nicely into polyamory and open relationships. We got some really good insights from Reddit discussions on this. It seems like these terms get mixed up a lot.
They do. Yeah, the Reddit threads were helpful there. They clarified that polyamory is generally understood as a form of ethical non-monogamy, where everyone involved is openly free to have multiple romantic relationships.
Romantic being the key word there.
Right. It emphasizes those emotional, intimate connections alongside the physical. And crucially, it's all based on open communication, honesty, and agreement among everyone involved. No secrets, no cheating on agreed boundaries.
Okay, so how is an open relationship different then?
Well, within the poly community, open relationship often clarifies that the openness is primarily for sex, not necessarily for developing deep romantic attachments with others outside the primary relationship. Ah, I see. So it's like a specific type within ethical non-monogamy, but not the same as polyamory, where multiple romantic bonds are common.
Exactly. That seems to be the general distinction people make.
And one of the Reddit threads tackled a big misconception, right? The idea that in polyamory, everyone dates everyone else, like one big group thing.
Yeah, that's a really common myth. The reality, according to the discussion, is that the vast majority of poly folks have dyadic relationships, meaning two-person relationships.
So I might have a relationship with partner A and also with partner B, but A and B aren't necessarily involved with each other.
Precisely. Your partners aren't expected or required to date each other. They might not even meet, or they might just be acquaintances or friends. It varies hugely.
That's really important to clarify. The idea of forcing partners to date each other, the thread called that potentially abusive.
Yes, they use strong language, highlighting that individual autonomy is still really key within ethical polyamory.
Okay, and within a polyamorous network, a polycule, is that the word?
That's the term, yeah. Like a molecule, but for poly relationships.
Cute. So within a polycule, there are different ways people interact.
Mm-hmm. They mentioned kitchen table polyamory. That sounds cozy.
It does. What does it mean?
It suggests a level of friendliness and comfort where everyone, like all the partners and metamors, your partners can hang out together comfortably, maybe share meals, socialize. But again, it doesn't mean they're all dating each other.
Just a friendly, connected network.
Yeah. And then there's parallel polyamory.
Sounds like the opposite.
Pretty much. Partners have separate relationships, and there's very little interaction between the metamors. They run on parallel tracks, basically.
Okay. And there are probably variations in between, too.
Oh, absolutely. And these styles aren't fixed. They can shift and evolve within the same polycule over time, depending on what feels right for everyone.
Flexibility seems key. The discussions also mentioned being primary in polyamory. How did they explain that? Is it like a ranking?
They were careful to say it's not necessarily a hierarchy in a healthy polyamory. It's more about a deep, significant commitment to building a life together. Maybe share finances, living together, long-term plans, similar to big commitments in monogamy. But it's a mutually agreed upon dynamic, not about one relationship being inherently better or more important than others.
Got it. So it describes the type of commitment, not necessarily a ranking of value.
That seems to be the idea. And a really crucial point came up for anyone thinking about polyamory.
Which is, yeah.
You absolutely need to find partners who are also enthusiastically on board with it. Trying to, like, convert someone who wants monogamy into a poly relationship.
Recipe for disaster.
Almost certainly, yeah. Conflict, heartbreak. And the threads also reminded people that even in non-monogamy, things aren't always perfectly equal. Time, affection, sex. It won't always be balanced between all partners.
So navigating those differences requires
ongoing, open, honest communication. And a lot of understanding, as always.
Communication again. Okay, let's circle back to swinging for a moment. Using the Wikipedia info, it echoes the earlier definition. Non-monogamous sexual activity, individuals or couples, primarily for recreation.
Mm-hmm. And it mentions that old problematic term, wife swapping. Good riddance to that one.
Definitely. Wikipedia lists motivations, too. Wanting more or better sex, variety, curiosity.
And interestingly, for some couples, it's seen as a way to actually strengthen their bond.
How so? By avoiding secrets?
Yeah, by being open about desires, promoting honesty, avoiding affairs.
Yeah.
That's the idea for some.
It's fascinating how different couples frame it. And it happens in various places.
Yep. Informal gatherings, dedicated clubs, hotels, resorts, cruises, even online platforms connecting people. And that 2018 estimate suggested over 2% of U.S. adults identified as swingers then.
Still a relatively small percentage, but not insignificant.
Right. And some research apparently suggests swingers might even report higher relationship happiness than average.
Interesting. But the risks. STIs must be a major consideration.
Absolutely. Wikipedia addresses that directly. It's a risk, just like with any casual sex. Practices vary hugely. Some might not use protection, others are strict about condoms, testing.
So it's a mixed bag regarding safety practices.
It seems so. Some argue the community promotes safe sex and rates aren't higher than average. Others highlight the risks remain. It's definitely something anyone involved needs to be vigilant about.
For sure. The history bit was interesting, too. Maybe linked to Air Force pilots and WWII, though it's debated.
Yeah, and it definitely gained more visibility during the 60s free love movement and the swinging 70s.
Right. And it clarified the difference between full swap, penetrative sex, and soft swap, non-penetrative.
Mm-hmm. Apparently, newcomers often start with soft swapping and that whole key party idea. Probably an urban legend.
Good to know. Okay, now for a really different dynamic. Dominance and submission, or Ds.
Right, a specific subset of BDSM.
Yeah.
Wikipedia defines it as one person willingly submitting to another in an erotic context or lifestyle. Pleasure comes from either dominating or being dominated.
And the absolute crucial first point, as Wikipedia stresses, is consent.
Paramount.
Yeah.
Absolutely central. This is what fundamentally separates consensual Ds from abuse or non-consensual acts. They mention principles like SSC.
Safe, sane, consensual.
Right. And RACK, risk-aware consensual kink. And the four Cs, caring, communication, consent, and caution. These are foundational.
Good. So it's built on a framework of safety and agreement. The history goes way back.
Potentially, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe 18th century, maybe earlier mentions in things like the Kama Sutra. Early psychology wrongly linked it to pathology, but understanding has evolved. Prevalence is hard to pin down. Studies vary a lot.
And it can look very different from one relationship to another.
Hugely. It can be highly ritualized or totally free form. It involves intense negotiation wishes, limits, needs. Can be sexual, non-sexual, short-term, long-term, intimate, anonymous.
Wow, very flexible. What's the appeal, generally?
Often it's about seeking intensity, deep trust, a unique kind of intimacy.
Okay. And there are different terms. Dominant, dom. Dom for a female dominant. Submissive, sub.
Switch for someone who enjoys both roles. Dominatrix usually refers to a professional woman who dominates for pay. Maledom for a dominant male.
And vanilla means?
Mainstream normative sex or relationships. Outside of BDSM kink.
Got it. And power exchange. That sounds key.
It is. It describes how the dominant feels empowered by the submissive's surrender. But, and this is crucial, the submissive ultimately holds the real power through their ongoing consent. They set the boundaries.
So the power dynamic isn't as simple as it looks on the surface.
Not at all. Top and bottom are sometimes used similarly, maybe focusing less specifically on the sadomasochism aspect.
And dungeons, are those literal dungeons?
Sometimes dedicated spaces for play, yeah. Maybe. Not necessarily underground.
Yeah.
And they often have dungeon monitors to ensure safety and consent protocols are followed.
Safety seems paramount. Can Ds exist in different relationship structures?
Absolutely. One dom with multiple subs, vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
Monogamous Ds, polyamorous Ds. And romantic love isn't always part of the equation.
Fantasy role play is common too.
Very. Authority figures, animals. And the range of actual activities is, well, almost limitless. Impact play, bondage, sensory stuff, servitude, fetishes, humiliation.
It sounds incredibly varied, but with intensity comes risk.
Absolutely. Wikipedia addresses safety risks. Physical injuries like bruises, nerve damage, burns. STIs are a risk too. And tragically, in rare cases, death can occur, often from things like erotic asphyxiation going wrong.
That's sobering.
And negative emotional states are possible too if boundaries are crossed or communication fails. Which brings us back again to...
consent.
Exactly. It's vital. Can be verbal, or even written things like scene contracts or slave contracts.
Contracts, wow.
Yeah, formalizing agreements. And safe words are crucial, often a traffic light system, red, yellow, green, or silent gestures, to communicate limits or withdraw consent instantly.
So there are clear mechanisms to stop or slow things down.
There have to be. They even mentioned consensual non-consensuality, CNC.
What's that?
It's a complex, pre-agreed scenario where within the scene, consent appears waived, but only within very specific negotiated safe limits. It requires immense trust.
Wow. Okay. That really highlights the level of communication needed. And collars, symbolic.
Can be, yeah. Symbolizing submission in Ds. But people wear collars for fashion in other subcultures too, so you can't just assume.
Right. And Ds themes pop up in culture. Books, music, films.
Yeah, Venus and Furs, The Velvet Underground, Rihanna's S&M, films like Secretary, 50 Shades. It shows these dynamics resonate culturally in various ways.
Okay. Just a couple more quick points from the sources before we wrap. One was about secretive non-monogamy.
Ah, yes. Basically, cheating or affairs. Yeah. The point was that while it might be common, social attitudes are overwhelmingly negative.
Because of the betrayal and dishonesty.
Exactly. It highlights that crucial difference between consensual non-monogamy, where there's agreement, and non-consensual, where trust is broken. Gender norms and power dynamics often influence how it's judged, too.
Mm-hmm. And lastly, polyandry and polygamy.
Right. Polyandry, one woman, multiple husbands, still exists in some traditional societies, but it's not legally recognized in most Western countries.
And polygamy, multiple spouses, usually understood as one man with multiple wives.
Also, generally not legally recognized, often carries penalties.
Mm.
Due to public policy, gender equality concerns, legal values focusing on a two-person union.
So the law, in most places, still reflects that two-person marriage model, even if personal practices are more diverse.
Pretty much, yeah. It shows the gap that can exist between legal frameworks and lived realities.
Wow. Okay. We have covered a huge amount of ground today.
Right.
This is like deep dive.
We really have.
From those like invisible power dynamics and everyday relating to the very intentional world of D's consent and all the diverse ways people structure non-monogamous lives.
Hmm.
It's just clear relationships are so personal, so varied.
Absolutely. And I think if there's one thread running through everything we talked about, it's got to be communication.
Totally. Open, honest communication.
Consent,
mm-hmm.
respect, and really truly understanding your own needs and desires and your partners or partners.
Yeah. Whether you're monogamous, trying to balance power, or exploring alternatives, those seem to be the absolute bedrock for healthy, fulfilling connections.
Couldn't agree more. Foundational stuff.
So for everyone listening, as you think back over this, what really resonated? What surprised you? Maybe what challenged some assumptions you didn't even know you had about relationships?
Hmm.
Remember, this is just a starting point, right? A prompt for your own exploration.
Definitely.
We really hope you'll keep thinking about these ideas in your own life. Like, what does feeling seen and heard truly mean for you? How do you navigate power in your connections? What kind of relationship structure, deep down, feels most authentic to your values?
These are big questions. Ongoing conversations, really. With ourselves, with others.
Yeah. And hopefully this deep dive gave you some useful insights for continuing that exploration. Maybe a final thought to chew on. In this world where we see so many different models, so many ways to connect, how can each of us cultivate a deeper self-awareness about what we really need in relationships and then find the courage to communicate that authentically, whatever our connections look like?
That's a powerful question to end on. Food for thought.